Kidnappers are the easy ones. Kidnappers are easy to deal with, relatively speaking. The number one skill of the world's best negotiators, regardless of what industry or sector you're doing it in, is...
Today on Influence Anyone, I'm joined by Scott Walker. He is a former Scotland Yard detective and kidnap for ransom negotiator. He's negotiated with armed criminals, managed terrified families, and built trust when one wrong word could cost a life. But here's the truth. If you can't regulate yourself, you cannot influence anyone. And so today, we're breaking down emotional discipline, high-stakes communication, and how to stay calm when everything is on fire. Hi, I'm Howie Chan, influence strategist and founder of The Behavioring Company. Let's get into it.
All of us, doesn't matter who you are, all 6-7 billion of us, all of us want to feel seen, heard, and understood. And I had to do that with every single kidnapper that we communicated with. They needed to feel that they could trust us. But there's three elements to a negotiation. The first one is information gathering. You've got to find out what's going on and what's working for the other side and everything else. The third bit is problem solving. But the middle bit, the big chunk that takes up 80% of successful negotiation and communication generally, is...
What if your team didn't just know more about influence, but actually used it to drive real results? At The Behavioring Company, we help organizations turn brand and behavioral science into a strategic advantage, whether it's turning prospects into fans or employees into ambassadors. If you're looking for a keynote speaker, an interactive workshop, or a full-on strategy sprint, let's talk. Go to howiechan.com/speaking or click on the link in the show notes. Let's make influencing human behavior your company's superpower.
Scott Walker, the man, the myth, the legend, welcome. So grateful to have you here.
It is my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me on, and I am really looking forward to this conversation.
I read on one of your many articles out there that you keep a stress ball on your desk. Is that true? And it has an acronym, WAIT.
It is true. In fact, one of my kids is on their desk right now. It's, why am I talking? And it was given to me many years ago by a far more wiser and astute communicator than I was at the time. And it's constantly be asking yourself, why am I still talking? If I'm talking, I'm not listening. I'm not necessarily finding out information about the other person. And if I'm not finding out information, actually, how can I really meet them where they're at? How can I help them? How can I serve them? What's the outcome of that conversation going to be? So it's a great reminder. If I feel I've been talking for too long, I just need to take a breath, pause, and check in with the other person. So yeah, it's a great reminder for sure.
It's one of those things that you hear a lot, I think, about we have 2 ears and 1 mouth, so we should be listening twice as much as we speak. And it's something you talk about too, first understand and then be understood, right? Something that Clevy talked about years ago.
That's a cliche, isn't it? But it's cliche for a reason. Is again, I've found that there's a danger if you're making assumptions. Going in, you're thinking what the other person wants or needs or what you're hearing, or you want to make it all about yourself. It really ends up working out for the best long term unless you approach it from first seek to understand before being understood. And that goes to the heart of the golden rule of successful negotiation. And that doesn't matter whether it's personally or professionally, is it's not about you.
So you were a kidnap for ransom negotiator, and that's where you learned and become really good at what you do, which is the art of negotiations, communication. Now, what kind of training did you have before that to get into that?
A lifetime of just being really inquisitive and nosy and curious about why things worked out the way they did. Why do human beings think, feel, and act the way they did, regardless of circumstances or particularly in times of stress and overwhelm and uncertainty? But even going further back as a kid, I was always asking why. Why is the sky blue and the grass green? Literally, they were my questions as a five-year-old.
Your parents crazy.
I drove my parents crazy. I drove my aunts and uncles and my grandparents to the extent that even 20, 30 years later, it would still come up at family gatherings. And Scott, you were quite inquisitive. It was a little bit interesting and a little frustrating at times because I was never satisfied around the answer. And there's always this inquisitive curiosity around, okay, why? And that, I guess, has never left me. And I went into the police. I was a detective for 16 years at Scotland Yard. And again, police officers the world over, you get this ringside seat into humanity. You're experiencing or you're sharing or you're entering people's lives, usually at the lowest moment or significant moment, certainly. And it just gives you a ringside seat into the human psychology, into the human condition, really. And because I had that inquisitiveness, that curiosity, it gave me a certain level of courage to apply for roles and seek out opportunities in my career. I took some time out. I went out to Iraq and I worked as part of a military interrogation team where we debriefed and questioning insurgents, running agents and informants to get information from them, working with the UN. Predominantly, the experience was as a cop, as a street cop, as a detective. And yeah, it just gives you so much exposure to, so much opportunity to communicate with people day in, day out. And that experience then led me to eventually getting into the kidnap for ransom world.
And before that, Scott, weren't you in the army as well? And I think you started off as a barrister's clerk. Like, how was that between school doing that and what transformed how you were thinking about this and then starting off being on the street like a cop? It seems like a thing that you want to do. Have you always wanted to do that as a kid? I want to be a cop.
Well, yeah, I worked in the legal office, the barrister's chambers, as it was. It was a work hard, play hard environment. But again, it was my first introduction to selling, because I was selling the lawyers, I was selling the barristers to get them to work, almost like a broker. So again, that was my first exposure to being able to influence and persuade people. And it was the more time I spent there, the more experience I got, the more work and the varied work I was exposed to. And then I got really interested in a lot of the criminal cases that we covered and the barristers worked on. And I thought, do you know what? That's about 6 years after I left school. I applied to join the police in London, moved down there, and as I said, spent 16 years. And then probably halfway through that, I took time out to go and do some work with the military, as I said, over in Iraq, which was, again, was another great experience dealing with recorded human intelligence, where it's all about debriefing or interrogating or eliciting vital information. Key intelligence that is going to support the coalition forces to succeed on their mission.
Yeah, it does seem, you tell me if it's true, Steve Jobs famously said, when you look back, you can connect all the dots. Is this something that you feel in your experience, you look back and be like, gosh, everything's connected to bring you to this point?
Yeah, I love that sentiment from Steve Jobs. I've heard it before and it's spot on though. Because when you're facing forward, when you're looking into your future, it's just a heavy, dense fog with brief glimpses of clarity, but predominantly you're just wading through, hoping for the best. I appreciate hope is not a strategy, and you can visualize, you can plan, you can goal set as much as you like, but it's still uncertain. But then when you look back, the stepping stones are crystal clear. The spotlight's on each one, and you go, okay, well, that decision led to that, which led to this, which then led to there, which is now enabled me to get to where I am today. Without all each one of those steps, which appeared so random at the time, it's obviously inevitable as to how it played out the way it did. I guess I'm grateful for the opportunities that I've had, albeit I've sought them out. And it's that great line, isn't it, where luck is when preparation meets opportunity. And it's really setting, well, I've just learned to stack the cards in my favor, stack the odds in my favor as much as possible by being clear about what it is I want generally, and then putting steps in place. And it's just literally one step in front of the other. And then you look back and you're going, okay, it all makes sense now.
Yeah. Did you have a philosophy moving forward and taking the opportunities as they come? What was your philosophy making those decisions as you moved forward?
I like the Richard Branson's line of just say yes and work out how you're going to do it afterwards. And then it's true though. I think people, there's a big thing at the moment where it's all just say no and take control and turn down stuff. And I get that. You don't want to be distracted by the noise. You've got to stay laser focused on what it is you're doing. But there's a danger in doing that is you miss something even better. It's like when people go to negotiation with, they call it a bat nut, the best alternative to negotiate agreement, which can work. But if you go in with that, you're potentially going to leave literally or metaphorically money on the table because you're going to be blindsided or not being able to identify something even better. And so the philosophy I had was say yes more often than no, particularly at the beginning, and just trust my intuition. Does this feel the right thing to do? Not does it feel easy, but does it feel instinctively the right thing to do? And if so, okay, but why is that? Is this in alignment with what I'm looking to build or create or do? Or is it actually, do you know what? It's just going to be really interesting. Is it outside my comfort zone? It's all about just expanding that threshold of control, being more comfortable with being uncomfortable increasingly. And what would have worried me or made me nervous 10 years ago, now I do without even thinking. I always remember I do lots of keynote talks and fireside chats and go all over the world doing this stuff now, which I love. I remember, I know, 20 plus years ago, I'm a young detective at Scotland Yard and I had to give a briefing to a room of officers, senior officers. And I'm stood in front of the lectern, the podium, and I can't stand too close to it because my knee is shaking so much. It's actually making a knocking noise. And so I go to take a sip of the glass of water and I can't because my hand's shaking so much and I can't pick up my notes or hold a pen because it's shaking. And I remember the presentation bombed. It was awful. But I remember standing there just dripping in sweat, pounding headache, embarrassed, thinking, I've got to grip this. There's no way I could go through life not being able to deliver a really good presentation or talk. And so, again, I trust in my gut and I just sought out every opportunity I could. I volunteer for everything. This is when I was in the police. I just volunteer for every presentation, every briefing, every engagement, anything that got me to be uncomfortable, standing in front of a room full of people. And essentially what we do when it's in business, in policing, in our families, you're looking to convey a message. You're looking to communicate and ultimately bring about some form of cooperation or collaboration. You're selling a story, you're selling an ideal, you're selling an outcome or a result. And that's what it is. And you look at all the world's best speakers, that's what they do. That's what they're so good at. It's conveying that story, making it real and relevant for the recipient.
But I think there's a crossroads there. I love that. I mean, what a great story. But I feel like with every failure, there's this crossroads where you feel that pain. And it's either you go, I'm never going to let this happen again. I'm going to do what it takes. Or you go into the corner and say, I'm never going to do it again. So you not do it again. So how did you make that choice? And is this nurture, nature? Do people with certain traits choose A versus B? What are your thoughts, Scott?
Yes, that's a really interesting point. And I think it goes to the heart of how and why we make decisions. And it's that classic to avoid pain and move towards pleasure. And we will look to avoid pain more than we move towards pleasure. And usually people make the decision to stop smoking, leave the relationship, change their jobs, do a speaking course, whatever it is, when they'll go, that's it. Not another moment. It needs to change now. And it goes to the heart of, there's a number of steps to this. The first one being an awareness. You need to be aware of this. You then need to acknowledge it rather than be the ostrich, burying your head in the sand. you've got to acknowledge, okay, this is where I'm at. And then crucially, the next stage is you've got to accept responsibility. You've got to accept it. There's no point saying, I wish it was different. That will come later. But right now, you've got to be aware of it. You've got to acknowledge it. Then you've got to accept it and go, right, I'm going to accept 100% personal responsibility for doing something about it. And I think we often outsource our bundles of agency that we all have to actually take some steps and do something, whatever it is. And so it does come back to that leverage. You want to leverage the pain on yourself, which is what I did. I thought, well, do you know what? I don't want to ever find myself in a position where I can't go and speak to somebody. Well, I can't try and persuade or cooperate or seek some kind of cooperation. But you could apply that financially. In the early days of setting up by myself in business, I made some really poor financial decisions. And the pain point of that was like, right, I am never going to allow myself to get in that position ever again. And so you can read all the books, you can do all the courses, you can do whatever. But until you hit that threshold of taking the personal responsibility and then doing something about it, because then that empowering future has to be more enticing, more enjoyable, more benefit than the pain. Otherwise, that's how people fall into the spiral of depression and doom and gloom because they can't see a more empowering future.
Yeah.
And so that's, for me, it's about, yeah, taking the responsibility and making that decision right there that enough is enough. That's it. I'm going to move away from the pain if I stand still. If there's more pain by doing nothing than by actually moving towards that empowering future. And I think Jocko Willink, doesn't it, former US Navy SEAL guy, talks about discipline is freedom. It's putting up with the temporary discomfort rather than languishing in the pain and despair of not seeking out those opportunities.
In your book, you talk about the red center. So really understanding yourself and being the right state to make those decisions. So what we've just been talking about, whether it's self-awareness or using our emotions, is just so key, I think, to what you do and to what we can all do when we communicate. There's this story that I love that you tell about a colleague that enticed you with this story about rescuing this person from a vicious Albanian gang. And then you're like, oh my God, I want to do that too. And you follow your feelings. Can you tell us that story and how it led you to this career?
Yeah, I'd been promoted a couple of points in my career. So I was the American equivalent would be a lieutenant. So whilst I enjoyed investigating crime, I loved it. I actually, by taking promotion, you become more of a desk jockey. And the only danger I was going to be exposed to really was paper cuts and a shiny backside from sat behind a desk all day supervising crime reports. And I bumped into an old friend of mine in the canteen in a police station in South London. And we tried to catch up. He looked tired. He looked really tired, but comfortably so, as if this has been a well-earned, hard-fought tiredness that I know he's going to sleep well. And he just told me about how he'd spend the last 4 or 5 days battling it out, negotiating the release of another human being, a hostage, a young teenage boy from the clutches of a really vicious Albanian drugs gang. And this young kiddie was the younger brother of actually another drug dealer, and they were seeking some kind of retribution against him. And he was telling me about all the challenges and the steps they had to take to rescue him, to negotiate his release. And I just thought, wow, that sounds far more interesting than what I was doing. And so in the end, he put me in touch with a team that ran that part of the business, so to speak, and had some conversations and applied and then went through the selection process. And then a couple of months later, I get the phone call. It's always at 2 o'clock in the morning. It's never lunchtime on a Wednesday, and I'm sat there thinking, I'm ready for a kidnap for ransom call now, please. It's always when I've got the kids, or it's a birthday party, or 2 or 3 a.m. And then, so my first call, again, 2 a.m., and I jump into the car, put the blue line, I'm going to race across London. And one of my main jobs then was to get alongside the family of the victim of the hostage and was to reassure them, to give them a strategy, some tools and techniques and a plan for what they were going to get, because they were the ones who were going to be speaking to the kidnappers, because the kidnappers don't want the police involved. And so I'd be helping them do that. And the family of 9 or 10 in a 2-bedroom tiny apartment. So you can imagine the scene is cramped. It smells a bit with all the tension and the sweat and the...
And this was their first case.
This is my first case. And so a rocker, and it's going reasonably well, and there's a far more experienced colleague than me who's there. I'm learning the ropes from.
Two of you guys.
Yeah. And somebody usually more experienced. And so I'm learning the ropes, obviously. But after a couple of days, they're just not listening to me, the family this is. They're not taking my advice. So we want to move them to another location because the kidnappers have said on one of the calls, we know where you live, and they gave the address. We know the police are there working with you. And so we're going to send some boys around with a MAC-10 to spray the place up.
Oh, my God.
And what a MAC-10 is, an absolutely lethal machine gun. And in the wrong hands, people who don't know how to use it, it's just an indiscriminate bloodbath. And I'm sat there thinking, okay, we don't really want to be here. As in, none of us need to be. We need to move to a safe location. But the family refused. And so we've got all this tension going on. And this is getting to me. Remember, this is my first case. And I'm still some young, trusting, ego-driven detective trying to humble myself.
How old were you then, Scott?
You can do the maths, but late 20s.
And so you're a detective for?
I've been in the police about 9 years at this point.
Wow. Yeah, so 9 years of experience. You feel like I've got some kind of a handle on this.
Yes, and this is a different level because most cops, just as a little sidebar, it's about problem solving. Okay, cops are really good. They're the best of the world at problem solving. But there's three elements to a negotiation. The first one is information gathering. You've got to find out what's going on and what's working for the other side and everything else. The third bit is problem solving. But the middle bit, the big chunk that takes up 80% of successful negotiation and communication generally, is relationship building. And most people go from step one to step three super quickly, and they almost just pay lip service to the key bit, the middle bit of relationship building. And that was me. I was really good at information gathering, and I was really good at problem solving. I wasn't so good at relationship building. And so I end up getting really frustrated with the family, with the parents, these poor parents whose young son had been taken. They were receiving torture videos, like really horrific stuff. And I just turn around to them and I say, worse the effect of, what is it you don't get about what I'm trying to tell you here? Why can't you just follow my advice? And if you do, we'll get your son back. But right now, you're making it worse. How do you think that worked out? And so I'm starting in this dialogue, this narrative with this poor family, this poor parents. And then I feel a hand on my shoulder by my former colleague. Yoda, really equivalent. And he squeezes my shoulder, Steve does. But that's enough. That little tiny imperceptible squeeze on my shoulder is enough to interrupt my pattern. Breaks my pattern. It breaks the spiral I've started going in. And then I step back and then I watch him give this masterclass in how to really influence and persuade and bring about cooperation and collaboration. And I was able to stand and watch, emotionally regulate. And then, thankfully, 48 hours or so later, we got the son back. And that highlighted to me the number one skill, the number, without doubt, without any kind of doubt, the number one skill of the world's best negotiators, regardless of what industry or sector you're doing it in, is emotional self-regulation.
What Scott just said might be the most important sentence in this entire episode. Most people lose influence and lose negotiations not because they lack the skill. It's because they lack emotional control. And that's exactly why I created something to help you very quickly called the 90-Second Influence Reset. It's a simple guide that can immediately help you get back on track so you can be centered, you can be your best self in a high-stakes setting. Print it out and it can be a reminder for you every time. Click on the link in the description below. And if you're listening to this on a podcast, it will be in the show notes. All right, now back to Scott.
Because if you can't regulate, in my previous life, people could die. But in business, you're going to lose the deal. In a personal setting, you're going to alienate and antagonize your family, friends, and loved ones. There's no scenario where a dysregulated nervous system is going to work well for you. It may force somebody to say yes in the heat of the moment, but you don't want that. You want somebody who wants to work with you or be with you personally or professionally for a long time.
So the training there, Scott, is just trial by fire. They drop you in. There wasn't like a, hey, Scott, here's a 2-week training program on emotional self-regulation.
No, I mean, there's courses where you go theory and you practice this stuff. And I can go into some of that in a moment. But you asked me a couple of questions ago around, is it nature or nurture?
Yeah.
Anyone and everyone can be taught how to negotiate and how to communicate more effectively. Okay, it's a teachable skill, but it's also a perishable skill. And what that is some people have to work at it harder than others, like anything though, but you have to get the reps in. It's like going to the gym. If you want to get a ripped, toned, super fit, super flexible, strong body, you don't go for 20 minutes once a month. It's better than nothing, but it ain't going to give you what you're looking for. You've got to get the reps in. You've got to consistently practice. And in a negotiation sense, life gives you opportunity all day, every day to practice.
Yeah. Where should we practice? What do we do? What do we, Scott? How do we practice this daily?
It's finding the opportunities where the risks aren't that high. So it's if your kids come in from school, or you got teenagers and they're having some friendship dramas, or the semicolon line social media that is being a bit unkind about them, or whatever it is. It's, as I said to you before, it's about first seeking to understand before being understood yourself. It's being able to demonstrate empathy. But before we get to empathy, we have to listen. But people go, what is that it, Scott? You're just telling me to listen. I said, yeah, okay. But if I was a fly on the wall in your life, I guarantee I'd put anything on this, that there are times when you listen attentively, but most of the time you don't. And I call it level 5 listening. And what that is, you've got to get beyond the, I'm just waiting for you to stop talking so I can now say my bit. I'm going to not listen just for the gist of what you're saying, because actually I'm waiting for the Amazon delivery guy, or I'm hungry, or I'm thinking about my next meeting or call I've got to jump on. What I need to listen for is your point of view, your belief system, your values, your needs in that moment. It's what is not being said rather than just the words. Is there a mismatch between what you're saying and how you're saying it? And all of us, doesn't matter who you are, all 6-7 billion of us, all of us want to feel seen, heard, and understood. And I had to do that with every single kidnapper that we communicated with. They needed to feel that they could trust us, that when we handed over the ransom money, that we weren't going to rip them off, we weren't going to look to ambush or kill them. And equally, I needed to trust them that they weren't going to kill the hostages and just run off with the money.
Yeah.
And if you bring it back to a personal setting, your kids need to be able to trust that if they come to you with a challenge or a problem, or they're displaying perhaps unhelpful behaviors, let's say, they need to trust that you're going to provide a safer environment. You're going to help them regulate by making them feel seen, heard, and understood. It doesn't mean you agree with them, or you're acquiescing, or you're condoning. I didn't agree or condone what the kidnappers were doing. Well, I couldn't sit in judgment on them. Just so you can't sit in judgment on your clients, your colleagues, or your kids. And yeah. So that first step of listening deeply, is it they need to save face? Are they driven by ego? Are they just a bit afraid? Whatever it is. And then you, the empathy. Empathy is a doing word. It's not taking on the burden and the pain and the suffering of the other person. That's sympathy and pity. Keep it for that. But empathy is simply me demonstrating or me attempting to demonstrate my understanding of where you are at.
Yeah, that's so hard, isn't it? That's so hard. I got to imagine it's hard at the beginning, especially with negotiating for people that kidnap somebody. And in your mind, oh my God, it's all my, what have you done? Yeah, you're trying to empathize.
Kidnappers are the easy ones. Kidnappers are easy to deal with, relatively speaking. Where 80% of my time was spent was on my own side, dealing with the client, usually some corporate client, crisis management team, or families. 80% of my time on a kidnapping case was spent managing what we call the crisis within the crisis.
Why is that, Scott? What's going on internally that's so different from the external side?
Predominantly human nature. You've got ego, you've got high emotions, you've got internal politics, you've got competing demands, silo thinking. No different to, you take any business. If we went into any business anywhere in the world, and I reckon the feedback we would get is, actually the customers, the clients, it's pretty straightforward. But most of the issues facing that company will be internal. It will be disgruntled employees, a lack of performance, toxic culture, whatever it is.
It's just all the things that's under the surface, it seems. It's just under surface. It's not explicitly stated. So if you don't spend the time to listen, you don't get to see that. Is that part of it?
When you take the time to step back just slightly, all you need is an extra couple of seconds of pausing, the power lies in the pause. You get the stimulus, you get the trigger, you get the email, the text message, the comment, whatever it is. Most of us say or do something we later regret in the first couple of minutes after that.
Yeah.
Whereas if we could just buy time, a second, a split second to pause, take a breath, feel the feeling that's in the body, because usually it will show up in a churning in the body or tension in the neck or what. Feel the feeling, drop the story, allow your body to, again, to your nervous system to regulate. And the quickest way of doing that is used by some breath work, some deep breathing or whatever it is. And then you can just ask better questions. According to my immediate action drill, first step is to interrupt the pattern, which is what Steve did, remember, in that apartment by touching my shoulder. You then got to allow that cortisol and adrenaline to pump through you for 90 seconds. And then you can ask better questions such as, okay, what am I missing here? What does this person need from me? What's the opportunity here? What do I need to find out? And that's where the growth, that's where the learning, that's where the development really happens. But there's no way you'd be able to deal with that if you were at 30,000 feet being highly irate and emotional. And remember, we are emotional creatures that think, not thinking creatures that feel.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
So by the listening, by the empathizing with our kids or colleagues, we have to be able to identify the emotions that are present for that person, as well as ourselves. And if we can, we call it out. There's a saying, name it to tame it. If we can identify and name those emotions, it brings the proverbial elephant from the corner to the center of the room. Let's deal with this. You're not, people think, well, if I say this, it's just going to inject or insert this into their heads that wasn't already there. But it was already there anyway, even if it's subconsciously. And so we can't avoid it. We can't ignore it. We've got to be able to deal with it. And the best negotiators do that. They're not afraid of conflict almost. And we'll do that with kidnappers. We would, the kidnapping demands, initial demand maybe, let's say $10 million. You're never going to get $10 million. Not even going to get $1 million. Quite early on, we have to have what we call the conflict call. This is where we manage expectations, give them a significantly lower figure to start off where we're going to negotiate from. But that's the same in business and life. It's not being afraid of having really difficult conversations that you know you need to have to manage expectations. You don't have to be rude or belligerent or obnoxious in how you deliver it. You've got to be firm but fair. Be direct. Cut to the chase. And again, look to do so with empathy where you're seeing it from the other person's perspective as well.
I feel like for me, that's always so hard as a person that almost someone that feels for people, having a lot of empathy. I take on those feelings. So whenever I get into high conflict situations, I can feel it. Like my heart starts pounding. I can feel sweating. And I have two little kids and a lot of times they trigger me and then I get into that state. And it's only until later then I think about, oh, I should have done that or I should have just stayed in there. Or there are situations where I'm able to hold on and let the feeling wash over me. But I get caught in those situations at the moment. What can you do, Scott, for people that get triggered maybe that you can do in the moment and then maybe day to day you can practice for that, put in the reps, if you will?
Yeah, I think it goes back to that immediate action drill. It's keeping your back pocket. You've got to do the reps. You don't just do it once and then your neurological wiring has all been changed. Don't get me wrong. I will still lose my shit at times. And kids are the best, and family members are the best ones. They know exactly not just which buttons to press, but for how long, how many times they can override the safety button.
Yeah, they know the combination. They know,
the combination. No matter what security you put on those, they find a way through it. And you know what? Great. Because each time you deal with it, in the moment, it's really difficult. And what you do is you just extract yourself if you can. By time, you get that trigger and you feel yourself getting riled up. That is the moment just to go for a walk outside. Do some jumping jacks in the corner if that's your thing. Take a sip of water. Just interrupt the pattern. Go for a walk. Whatever it is, come back, feel the feeling, I say, but drop the story as to why you're feeling it, allow it to subside, and then come back in. We do this, the third bit, generally anyway, most of us can get to there, which is when we might feel bad afterwards. If we say something in the moment, we go, I'm really sorry, I shouldn't have shouted at you, or you feel guilty for doing something. We almost want to not feel guilty for doing something, but we want to get to that calm state as soon as we can. And I think the magic lies in being able to reframe stuff. We're meaning-making machines, human beings. We make meaning. You and I can experience exactly the same situation and circumstances. For one of us, it's the end of the world. That's it. Game over. For the other person, it's what a great opportunity to reevaluate my life and do something else. And it comes down to the meaning we give things. And I think by doing that, you bring a different energy, a different intention. And rather than looking to blame, name, or shame other people or situations when we get riled up and get triggered in that moment, we need to just be a bit more curious. Bring more curiosity than assumption. Bring more interest in other people and situations and ask better questions. And then above all, give a better meaning. And this is not some toxic positivity that gets bandied around and some people can levy against me and others and yourself maybe. You get to choose. All of us get to choose what meaning we give, what we're focusing on in any given moment. So we might as well choose something pretty positive and pretty good because we get to choose anyway. And the story we tell ourselves about the situation or the circumstances, we get to choose that as well. We get to change it. If we can change it, it can give us a far better quality of life, certainly from our emotions. And the better quality of emotions we experience, the better quality of life. Because I'm sure I know some really super successful people. They never need to work another day in their life, yet they're miserable as anything. It's because they haven't mastered the meaning and the fulfillment piece and the empowering stories that they need to tell themselves.
Yeah, I think that's really powerful, what you talked about, which is putting the meaning, the right meaning, the meaning that you want, to what's happening to you. And that's what you get from it, right? If it's a positive meaning, you'll feel positive. If it's negative, you'll feel negative. We're all bound by the stories we tell.
Scott, when you were in public service and then going into the private sector, what was that transition like? Why did you decide to do that? What was around that?
I just turned 40. And some people may have said, Scott, this is just a midlife crisis. And I loved every single day pretty much of being a cop. I loved it. But I also knew that I wanted a second career. I didn't even think I really wanted to do. And so I'm still young enough to go and get a second or third career. And at the same time, a lot happened in a short space of time. Within about 4 or 5 months, I was thinking about leaving the police. And again, I was doing lots of negotiations, and I came home one day and I'd received a phone call that just effectively just took the winds out of my sails, so to speak, that my mom, unfortunately, took her own life.
And oh my gosh.
That for me was a real wake-up call, because there I was going all over the world saving lives, yet I couldn't save the one life that really mattered. And so for me, now maybe I'll talk about giving meaning to things. I realized in that moment, do you know what? I am not going to waste another freaking second of my life. I've got to take this experience, this knowledge, this desire to serve and do good into the next stage, into the next chapter. I didn't want her death to be in vain.
Were you and your mum close, Scott? Were you and
your... Yeah, like any parent-child relationship, had its ups and downs and that, but yeah, close, as most people probably
are.
And I thought, no one was going to come and save me, so to speak. There's some dark moments there, as you can imagine. But within the 4 or 5 months after that, I'd left my long-term career. I'd gotten divorced and I'd obviously lost somebody really close to me. And I remember sitting in my bedsit in my tiny apartment with nothing really, with just my passport and my bag sitting on the floor. But I thought, this is it. This is the moment where I've got to use all the skills that I've been taught, all my experience, thinking I've got to change the meaning. As I said, I've got to make this not be in vain. And then I then went to work for a small boutique crisis management, crisis response consultancy in the City of London. There's only two or three of these firms in the world that specialize in kidnap for ransom and extortion, negotiations of piracy. And so I then spent the next several or so years throwing myself into that and going all over the world, being able to, again, sit down with families, being able to support and serve them to get their loved ones back.
When your mom passed, it definitely felt, like you said, an event that sort of changed your perspective. What was your perspective before and after?
Before, my life was really about me. It was, what do I want? What's in it for me? And we've all got an ego, and ego is not a bad thing. It depends what you do with the ego and the kind of ego that you have. But this was, okay, very driven, which is a good thing. I was looking for about, okay, what could I get from stuff? What could I get from this? To the detriment of everything else. But the wake-up call really was, I had this fear. My biggest fear is, at the time, was the day that I die is meeting the person I could have been and not being happy with what I saw. And so I thought, this has got to be about doing something beyond and above myself. And I look back, you talk about the beginning, about all those stepping stones, that I took that as, I don't know, as a sign, whatever, that actually all of these things that have happened to me have led me to this moment to actually do something with it, to not waste the experience and the gifts and the skills that I've been given. And overnight, it just literally changed. I remember waking up one day, literally the whole meaning I was giving thing changed. And that's when I got into the private sector. And then eventually when I left that, it was going even bigger. It was going into companies and organizations and charities. And ultimately, Harry, it came down to, how can we have better conversations? That's what it all comes down to. It doesn't matter whether it's with kidnappers, with somebody suicidal, with your kids, with your clients or colleagues, neighbors, community groups, with ourselves. It's how can we have better conversations? And I don't know about you, but I think the world needs better conversations right now. And that for me was, yeah, I get the driving force behind doing that. And that is another reason for why I wrote the book and why I wanted to do all these talks. Bearing in mind 20 years previously, I couldn't even stand on the stage without shaking and spitting water and dropping pens and papers and stumbling over my words. And so, yeah, that was the next stage.
Your mom would have been so proud of all the things you've done so far. Published author. Did you even think you could be a
published author at that point? Like a lot of people, I think everyone thinks they've got a, well, most people think they've probably got a book in them. There's one thing having a book in your head. There's another thing actually sitting down, putting your ass in a chair when you don't want to and writing it and then getting it published. I think life's too short to have regrets about conversations you've had that you wish you never had, as well as the ones that you wish you had. And again, it's just how can we learn to seek cooperation and collaboration? Again, doesn't mean you're acquiescing, you're condoning, you're accepting something you don't, but it's about where can we seek cooperation and collaboration? How can we have conversations with a purpose? And how can we just spend the time to listen more, talk a bit less, and yet just bring a better quality of life, right?
When you were doing all that work and going over to the corporate side, was there an element of, oh, I'm giving up on something exciting? Because, you know, we talked about this, how you transitioned to this work because it was exciting. And then now doing corporate work, do you feel like you're selling out? Do you feel like there's less excitement there? What are your thoughts, Scott?
Hey, I loved every day of being a cop. And there were days, many days I thought, I can't believe I'm getting paid to chase around after bad guys with guns and flashing lights and speeding cars and all the satisfaction of identifying and tracking down and putting a really violent criminal behind bars. The satisfaction for that is immense. But equally in the private sector, with all the cases and all the work that I've done there, it brings a different sense of fulfillment. Don't get me wrong, you get to a stage in life where if you're constantly seeking excitement, maybe there's a bit of a trauma response there. Hey, I still love adventure and excitement, but my cup gets filled up, to use that cliche, when I see somebody coming up to me at an event or they reach out to me online and just say, I read your book, or I came to your talk, or I did your course, and this is what I've done with it, and this is how it's improved my life, either my relationship with my partner, or I've increased the amount of clients I've got as a result of it. And I'm thinking, wow, I would never have thought 20 years ago that's where I would have ended up. But that brings itself a different level of fulfillment that is equally satisfying as racing around the world and jumping out of stuff. And
yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where if our kids were in the same class and it was a bring your dad to work day, you know, like a kidnapper and some negotiator sure sounds more interesting than someone like me doing brand consulting, you know what I'm saying? So
but you say that when my kids were younger, like kindergarten, primary school age, they, yeah, daddy's away chasing pirates, the novelty's worn off for them now. But it's all relative, right? Again, I look at anyone who's good at what they do, brand consulting, carpentry, artist, speaker, racing car driver, actor, whatever it is, whatever people do. And if they're really good at it, I could watch and listen and learn from them for hours. I just love it. Anybody who's good at what they do, well, you would have experienced this in the people that you've spoken to. People share similar traits, similar values and abilities, want a focus and determination and resilience and agility and a willingness to improve and add value and do something worthy. And yeah, I just find that fascinating.
Are there aspects of the corporate work that's even harder than the ransom work that you were doing?
Yeah, I think so. In terms of what would have been pretty straightforward, doing the negotiations with kidnappers. it's a transaction at the end of the day. The businessman just looking to get the best deal. But as I say, we factor in egos, internal politics, competing demands, loads of external influences, political or otherwise. It adds a whole new dimension to it. But again, you still bring the same skills, the tools and the techniques of, okay, let me listen, and I call it a sensory acuity radar that we have. It's when you walk into a room or you jump on a call with somebody, it's just tuning into, okay, what's going on for this person? Where are they at right now? And all of us have done this without realizing it. We want to bring a bit of a consciousness, a bit of intentionality to it. Because people tell you, they leak almost their pain points, but also the solutions, if you listen. So what right. words do they use? How do they communicate? But often we're just drowned out by all the noise that we bring, our own biases. We're not really focusing. We're not concentrating. We're worrying about what we're going to say next or making sure we get our side of the argument across. Whereas actually it's just taking a breath, taking a pause, sitting back, observing, and just allowing things to unfold.
Yeah, it's amazing how that same set of skills can be applied to so many settings. While the stakes are obviously different from one to the other, I remember you saying in a different podcast about the incredible success rate actually for kidnap for ransom cases. What has been a day that's toughest for you? What was like a really hard day for Scott Walker?
Yeah, the success rate's about 93% for negotiation. Not 100%, 93%. If there's a negotiation taking place with a professional negotiator, the high chance of the hostages coming back. And that's down to one thing, trust. As I mentioned earlier, trust on both sides. It takes time to build empathy, rapport building. They've got to be able to trust you, and you've got to be able to trust them. And bearing in mind, kidnap for ransom negotiations, it's the most unregulated, ungoverned, dangerous industry in the world. It works 93% of the time. So that tells you something. And the challenges that I would face particularly would be, on most cases actually, when things don't go according to plan. And if you think about it, you think a company might have supply chain issues or a bit of communication challenges. It's all there, magnified 1,000 times on a kidnapping case, because if you mess up, people can die. So it focuses the mind a little bit. And the challenges is when emotions raise their ugly head, so to speak, with a communicator that I'm using, perhaps because of a language barrier, and they end up shouting at the kidnappers. Or they then turn their frustration. It's not moving as quickly as you want onto you. And there's a case where really got punched by the client because he would take it upon himself personally that he was to blame for the kidnapping of his colleagues.
Oh, wow.
And in that moment, I'm like, I need to take the initiative and a calculated risk. It's the first part of all of this, really. Kidnappers can wait. I've got them where they are. We've got them in a good place. We've got them right down. They know we're going to pay some money. They're actually not going to harm the hostages despite threatening to do that. So I now need to put my attention and focus, as always, onto the communicator and the family and the client and get them engaged, again, emotionally regulated.
So the communicator is almost like in a crash course with you to do all these things, get emotionally regulated, the red scent, all these things that we talked about. So they're the ones actually talking to them.
They're the ones actually talking, because if I jump on the phone to a kidnapper in West Africa or the Middle East or somewhere, they're going to go, who's this white-sounding, middle-aged, middle-class British guy? What's he doing on the phone? And what that does is it then raises the perceived value and the profile of the hostages. Whereas we want to do the opposite. We want to reduce the expectations of the kidnappers. And so I will use a family member, somebody from the company, but usually there's a language barrier or there's a dialect. So we're going to get somebody who can really understand it. And so I'm literally coaching and training and scripting notes on what we're going to say for each call. And again, that can be applied to any part of business, is you've got to know what's your outcome, what's your result that you want, in our case, from that phone call? Is it to get a proof of life? Is it just to reassure the kidnappers that we're taking them seriously? Or is it to make an increased offer for more money?
Would this same format work for other negotiations, Scott? So like having someone that's doing the communicating and someone else that's doing the strategizing or decision making?
Yeah. And I'd always advise clients in the business world to, if you can, you want to separate the negotiations from the decision making. Even if it's just, do you want to separate it? Which is why we end up saying things such as, well, let me sleep on it. Let me think that over. That's a hardwired evolutionary subconscious going, I need to separate my decision-making from the actual negotiation.
So that's why I say, let me go talk to my wife.
Absolutely. Let me go speak to the key decision-maker here.
I need time. I gotta go talk to my wife.
And that applies because if you don't, you've got nowhere to go. Because if you're the final, which is why I would never want the big boss on the phone to the kidnappers. Because if you're the CEO of the company, hey, you can make any decision you want in the world about that particular case.
You can't buy time. You can't take a pause. You can't. That's right.
So separating the negotiation from the decision making. And that then enables the person doing the communicating and negotiating to be slightly more dispassionate or distant from it. Because actually, you can say what you like. It's not down to me. In terms of
it makes that distance. It gives you that distance to not react to.
That's key, man. I think from now on out, when I negotiate with my kids, I'll be like, hold on, let me go talk to mom.
Yeah, and it's asking yourself, what are they looking for here? What is it they need? Because
attention, Scott. It's usually attention.
It's usually attention, and you're okay. But why do they want attention right now? Is it because actually, I've promised something to them and I've not given it to them? And it's, put your jumper on. No, I don't want to put my jumper on. In fact, what you want to say is, do you want to wear the red or the blue jumper? You give them choice. Human beings love autonomy.
Yeah.
We love being able to make choices and decisions ourselves. But right, your kids will, they'll know which ones to press for sure.
Is there any sort of correlation between extrovertedness, introvertedness with being a good negotiator?
Not really, because people think the best negotiators, those you've got a sharp tongue, or they can talk the way out of anything.
Yeah.
But actually, the best negotiators listen more than they talk. And so if you're quite a gregarious, outgoing, extroverted type individual, there could be a tendency where you make it all about you, not maliciously, but you're a warm, emotive person. You love speaking and engaging with them. I do. You probably tell from the way we're having this conversation, I could talk for hours, but I know what I need to. I stay stumped.
You consider yourself an extrovert?
I cast myself as a people's person, but I'm probably an introvert. Am I an extroverted introvert? Whereas I could do a talk in front of 5,000 people, love it, be fully engaged.
Where do you get energy?
Yeah, exactly. This is it. And then I realized one day that where do I get my energy from? And that's actually afterwards I need to go and shut myself away, be by myself, going for a walk, relaxing. That's what I crave afterwards. So, and I guess that's the definition of an introvert.
No, I love that. I love that. Hey, so I love doing the research on you. It seems like you are a script writer too for true crime. Are you still doing that?
No, I did do some script writing for true crime podcasts, and I do enjoy the writing. The first book, All Out of Chaos, it took me 4 years to write it. But the second book, which is due out next year, actually has taken me about 10 months. So I'm getting quicker. And then because I do the process of writing, there's the TV rights have been bought for All Out of Chaos. That's quite exciting to see what happens with that. And
that's amazing.
There's a novel on its way, but not anytime soon, though. But I'm sure there'll be a novel at some point as well.
So someone's going to play you in a TV series.
Well, the protagonist anyway. I'm not sure it'll be me, but I think another of these books maybe have a semblance of truth, maybe.
That's so cool. That's so cool. Wait, when you were writing, you said it took you 4 years. What was holding you back? What was it like?
Life, I guess, but I was actually still doing the work, still doing negotiation at the time. This was before I discovered Stephen Pressfield's the Wall of Art and Go Professional. If you're familiar with
him, put that in the show notes.
Yeah, he talks about the resistance. Any artist, any entrepreneur, anybody who wants to create something, whether it's a book, a film, a business, will be perfectly familiar with the thing called the resistance. It's when you think, well, I need to sit down and write 1,000 words, but hang on, the refrigerator needs cleaning out. But first, I need to order my pencils in color order. Or it's staring at the blank page thinking, oh, my muse isn't coming to me today. Whereas actually, it's all BS. And actually, just get it done. Get it finished is better than not. And then you can always go from there. And so I realized when I started reading Stephen Pressfield's work that actually it's real. Be aware of it, acknowledge it, accept it, and then you can do something about it by
kicking it. Change from 4 years to 10 months.
It's becoming more disciplined and focused. And plus, I was stopping and starting previously, but whereas now, contractually, when you sign a contract with the publishers, you have to deliver. So that focuses the mind a little bit. But I think it's, if you do anything, you've got to be a professional at it. Whether or not you're parenting, writing a book, being a podcast host, if you just dabble at it, you get dabbling results. Whereas if you want to, it's not about getting the number one slot, although that's nice. It's, can you look in the mirror and go, that, whatever it is, the best I could produce, I've left everything on the table. You can look in the mirror, you can be pleased with really the only thing you can control, which is your effort and your input. The 5-star Amazon reviews, the feedback, all of that stuff is great, but you've got no control over it. All you've got is actually, have I given all my all and approached it as a professional would?
Yeah. Has there ever been a time when you were doing your negotiation work with kidnappers where it's like, oh crap, it's going south, it's really bad?
The very early days, there was a couple of cases where the hostages were in orange jumpsuits with a black flag flying behind them, knowing full well that the group that had taken them, terrorist organizations, knew that the chances of those hostages coming back was really slim. And so again, that more about it, another slight nuance, another context to the negotiations compared to, say, a straightforward criminal kidnapping where it's just for money, which we were allowed to get involved in. But yeah, there were cases where you've got the money, you want to hand the money over, but then the courier, the person, the poor person who you're getting to actually take the money to the drop point gets arrested. And then the local chief of police goes, we're not releasing him. And so then you send somebody to negotiate with the chief of police and you manage get the courier and the money released, most of the money. Obviously, there's local taxes and facilitation fees to pay. And then you think, great, okay, Mr. Courier. This is not FedEx, by the way. This is obviously somebody in these countries is trying to get the money on our behalf from one country across the border to the other without the authorities finding out. Because usually the authorities in these countries are turning a blind eye. And then the courier says, well, I want no more to do with this. And then runs off taking his commission. So you're left with the kidnappers thinking we're trying to rip them off. We've got no courier. We've got even less money. Meanwhile, the hostages are languishing in captivity somewhere. And so this goes back to the third element of problem solving. Okay. Thankfully, I've spent the time building the relationship with the kidnappers, but now we need to solve this. We need to get the money to them, the hostages back, and then find them. They then have to go into the drop-off, and then we get the hostages back, but then we need to get back to safety without getting kidnapped again. And so, yeah, it can be a challenging day in the office for sure.
Toof. That is absolutely... what an amazing experience, but yeah, I mean, I can't even imagine. It's really amazing to have you. I'll put the link to buy your book in the show notes. I've got it. It's right here. Order Out of Chaos. I loved it. And there's so many things that you can apply. I feel like I have to read through it a few times to really get all the value from it. I'd love to have you back with your next book. I bet it would be amazing. Obviously, watch the TV series when it comes out. Ah, there's so much good stuff in there. One question I'd love to ask you, I ask every one of my guests. Let's say if you have a chance to send a letter to yourself in the past, when would you like that letter to arrive and what would it say?
I'd probably send the letter to my teenage younger self, maybe at 13. You start your teenage years, and it would say something simple as, it always works out in the end. And I think when you're faced with all those challenges of finding who you are in the world as a teenager, actually you just need that guiding light to help navigate through that fog. And you know what? No matter what happens, it'll be okay in the end.
That's fantastic. Thank you, Scott. It was so much fun talking about negotiations and how we can apply it to real life. I have some strategies up my sleeve to work with my kids. So thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Scott negotiated with kidnappers, but he spent 80% of his time managing emotions on his own side internally. Think about that. In business, in parenting, in leadership, the crisis is rarely external. It's internal. If you want to go deeper, grab Scott's book, Order Out of Chaos. The link is in the show notes. And since you've made it this far, you already know that most people react and people with influence respond. So if you found any value from this episode, please respond by giving a review and a testimony. It helps us bring guests like Scott, world experts in influence, onto the show. In the meantime, please take a moment to leave that review, and I'll see you on the next episode of Influence Anyone. Take care.